This talk is offered by Ordinary Minds Zen teacher Andrew Tutel. Andrew is an Australian Dharma heir of Barry Madjid and is dedicated to extending Barry's vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Find out more at ordinarymind.com.au. Andrew's Zen teachings are made possible by donations from people like you.
So this morning we're going to be continuing with our lecture series on Indian Buddhist philosophy. And this morning is we're going to be moving to the second turning of the Dharma wheel. Now, as I've mentioned to you before, Buddhist philosophy is, you know, deeply psychological as well. And though at times it may seem quite abstract, it's actually pointing to, it's always based upon the fundamental, you know, Buddhist motivation to free ourselves from unnecessary suffering. And so even though we talk about some pretty theoretical things in Buddhist philosophy, they all come back down to helping us and guiding us in how we practice our meditation and how we practice in our everyday lives. You know, so for example, if someone's experiencing a headache, we often have sometimes an automatic thought and reaction such as, why me? And that particular thought, why me, then generates a whole loop of possible ongoing suffering. And so Buddhist philosophy points to to this question, well, what is this me that has the headache? Similarly, when someone criticizes me and I get very defensive and very reactive, again, the Buddhist philosophy is asking us to look at what's going on there. So it's deeply psychological. Why am I having this reaction to being criticized? And so forth. If I criticize someone else, who exactly is it am I criticizing? Is there a real person there that I'm criticizing, or is there actually a person there at all? Am I creating that person moment by moment? So today we're going to be talking about Nagarjuna, who's a very famous and very difficult Buddhist philosopher. And I can only give you a taste, a glimpse, but I want to give you enough of a taste to encourage you to look into his philosophy when you get the time. And don't worry about taking any notes, because you'll get a copy of my lecture notes. So starting with a quotation from a professor of philosophy called Jay Garfield, who translated Nagarjuna's work. He says, we naively and pre-theoretically take things as substantial. And this, as Nagarjuna will argue, is the root delusion that lies at the basis of all human suffering. So just a bit of a proviso, what we always do, this is being audio recorded. So please you're implying your consent to be audio recorded to go on the website if you participate in the discussion. And the format for these kinds of Sunday philosophy discussions are kind of like the Friday morning book club discussions. I'll be reading from the text and stopping every paragraph or so and asking you, do you have any comments or questions? And okay. So from the Buddhist perspective, the understanding and realization of emptiness is the key to liberation from suffering. Because the roots of suffering stem from primordial confusion as to the nature of reality. To be free from suffering, we need to eliminate ignorance. And to eliminate ignorance is to understand emptiness. Hence, the realization of emptiness is the ultimate medicine. And in this lecture series, we are exploring different ways of understanding emptiness, and they can get very finely nuanced. But we're just making three basic excursions. The first one, which we already talked about, the first turning of the Dharma wheel, looked at the emptiness of the personal self. The second turning of the Dharma wheel, which we're touching on today, looks at the emptiness of all phenomena, including the self, of course. And this is referred to as the Majjhimaka school, or the middle way school, which was founded by Nagarjuna. And the middle way school interprets the Prajnaparamita sutras, which you're all familiar with, the Heart Sutra. So the Heart Sutra is the most famous Prajnaparamita Sutra. Another one is the Diamond Sutra, which is very famous in Zen Buddhism too, because the sixth patriarch, Huaneng, came to his realization when he heard a monk reciting the Diamond Sutra. Prajnaparamita, Prajna. Meaning the perfection, paramita means perfection, prajna, wisdom, the perfection of wisdom, or wisdom, or realizing emptiness. So Nagarjuna is the founder of the Majjhimaka school, and he is the first and most influential of all Buddhist philosophers. Later in the series, we'll move to exploring the Yogacara view of emptiness, and we'll explore the question as to whether or not the Majjhimaka and the Yogacara schools are allies or rivals. That's quite a big debate. So before we talk about Nagarjuna, let's just quickly review where we were at last month. We ended on the topic of the Abhidharma. Abhidharma, sometimes translated as higher teachings. So the Abhidharma texts were the texts that were written by various monks, and they were kind of like, that's when the monks began to philosophize on the teachings of the Buddha. So they're different to sutras. They're actually written by the monks themselves. And the main viewpoint that we explored in the Abhidharma school was that ultimate reality is constituted by moments of experience, which they call dharmas. And in some of the Abhidharma teachings, they list, for example, 75 basic factors or dharmas which constitute reality. So these teachings were also known as Buddhist psychology, and these factors were kind of described in order to help people in the meditation practice to recognize these dharmas as they were arising. The Abhidharma teachings are associated with the Pali or the Theravada Buddhism, which you'll find in Burmese Buddhism and Thai Buddhism. And you'll also find Vasubandhu, who's also associated with Yogacara, who in the 5th century also wrote an Abhidharma philosophy text as well, called the Treasury of Higher Dharma. And that was very influential in the Indo-Tibetan tradition. In Sanskrit, abhi means making manifest. And dharma in this case means what can be known or cognized. The plurality of factors of reality, or simply what there is. So the attempt of the Abhidharma school was to do a kind of phenomenological categorization of these very these processes that constitute our psychological and physical reality. And so one of the reasons we study Buddhist philosophy, I'll just stop there. Are there any questions or comments so far? Jack? No? Sorry? No. Okay. Keep going. All right. So one of the reasons why we study Buddhist philosophy is to challenge our understanding and viewpoint about what is ultimately real. Because it is claimed that our primary confusion and hence suffering arises because of this ignorance of reality. So Buddhist teachings use both rational arguments, which you find in Nagarjuna, but they're also aimed towards direct perception or direct realization or seeing directly the nature of reality, which is more the experiential meditative component of this. So direct realization, prajna, to uncover the true nature of reality in order to be free from suffering. So these 75 dharmas, I'm just going to just very, very, very quickly, just to give you a bit of a feel. The majority of these dharmas are what are known as conditioned factors. There's only three unconditioned factors. So they list all the sort of physical forms. So you have the usual list of the senses, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, visual form, sound, smell, taste, touch, texture. Then they have one particular dharma called mind. Then they have a whole host of mental factors, lots of mental factors. Sensation, perception, attraction, contact, intention, discrimination, recollection, interest, concentration. They group them into what are called primary wholesome factors, like faith, diligence, equanimity, conscience, shame, non-attachment, non-aggression, non-violence, pliancy, conscientiousness. And they have unwholesome mental factors, delusion, heedlessness, laziness, lack of faith, lethargy, excitement, lack of conscience, shamelessness, fury, concealment, stinginess, envy, spite, hostility, resentment, pretense, hypocrisy, self-infatuation. None of us suffer from those mental factors, do we? And then we've got the variable mental factors and regret, sleep, conception, and probably one of the most important ones, discernment, which is a translation of the word prajna. And in the Amidharma teachings, prajna or discernment makes it possible to know. It's the kind of like the faculty which knows all the other dharmas. So very important, discernment. And discernment allows us to know the nature and function of the other factors. Other ones being attachment, anger, arrogance, doubt. Then they have some which are neither substantial nor mental: acquisition, non-acquisition, perceptionless serenity, state of non-perception, serenity of cessation, life, birth, fleeting stability, decay, impermanence, name, word, letter. When they talk about birth, that's kind of like how things come into existence very briefly, and they have a fleeting stability. They stay for a little while, and then they decay and go away. And the idea is to encourage us to notice this in our meditation practice. And then finally, the unconditioned factors. Space is one. And then cessation, translated as nirada or nirvana, cessation with remainder and cessation without remainder. They're just, when you see that with remainder, that's just referring to while the Buddha was still alive in the physical body. That's after he realized nirvana and he went around teaching, that's cessation with remainder. And when he died, that cessation without remainder. So unconditioned simply means not caused. And conditioned means it comes about due to causes and conditions. So any questions, comments? All conditioned elements arise, stay for a while, and then decay. That can happen like really quickly, or it might happen over a certain, we can actually observe something like a sound of the bell being born, staying for a little while and then going out again, and something else coming in. So the idea is, it's kind of got this stream of consistent, like just changing all the time, where we have this movement of dharmas coming together and then going apart, coming together, going apart, coming together, going apart, all the time. So that's the stream can know itself, and that's the prajna factor. All right, and if so, within that teaching, the prajna is a conditioned factor. So, any questions or comments on that before we move to Nagarjuna?
Andrew, I did have one question.
Yep.
On that list at the beginning, at the bottom, it had something called, I think it said imperceptible forms.
You're not going to ask me what they are, are you?
Was interesting.
Yeah, I'm not quite.
Do you know they are?
I didn't. I've got a book on it, but I didn't have time to look up what was meant by imperceptible forms. So I'm not quite sure. Any educated philosophers here can tell us what? Who? Any experts on the Abhidharma? Yeah. Okay. So I'm not sure, Phil. Leanne.
I'm definitely not an expert. Let's just get that straight. But it's interesting because when you brought that up, what image I got was an experience of that, really. And I'd never really thought about it before. I'd never put a name or a label to it. But, yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, what was it again, though? What forms the...
Imperceptible forms, neither substantial nor mental.
Imperceptible forms. So something that's not perceptible. So it has a nature and experience and a feel to it, to what those things are that have moved through me, that have arisen and, you know, passed away. There is that haziness of quality about them.
Yes, and it's number 11 there, Andrew.
Yeah, I see.
There definitely is a haziness of quality about it. It's like, yes, you cannot put a label to it. You cannot name it. And because, like most everything else, it's fleeting, they just come and go. But, yeah, I just wanted to say that because I never really put a label to those experiences before, and perhaps that's what they are. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Leanne. You find in the insight tradition, which in the West, you know, either usually came from Thailand or from Burma, and people like Joseph Goldstein, who wrote a lot about mindfulness practice in the insight tradition, and you'll find that Joseph talks a lot about these factors as well. So it was part of the insight tradition. The Amidharma teachings influence the insight teachings on meditation. So you get this recognition of dharmas in that kind of practice, which you don't get so much in Zen. So let me just come back down. Okay. Any other questions or comments? And remember, this is, I said before, I mean, I'm just going to do my best to give you a sense of Nagarjuna. It's in the short time we have. So let's get going. So metaphysics is in philosophy basically is concerned with the ultimate nature of reality. And there are some philosophers who maintain that Buddhism is metaphysical, and there are other philosophers who argue that Buddhism is anti-metaphysics, or it might be both. So is there an ultimate reality? And if so, what is it? So some commentators argue that Nagarjuna's philosophy is anti-metaphysical because his philosophy uses the technique of negation or reduction to absurdity of any attempt to conceptualize ultimate reality. So in the end, it kind of leaves only two options, and I'm not quite sure where I sit, and maybe we can go with both again. There's two options with Nagarjuna leaves us with. There is an ultimate reality, you could call it the absolute, but it is by definition beyond concepts. It's inconceivable and ineffable. It's beyond words, beyond concepts. I mean, that's one of the fundamental teachings of Zen that Bodhidharma brought with him. I mean, one of the reasons why I'm doing this philosophy thing is that a lot of these ideas do get imported into Zen. You see them in the koans, but we often don't have the background story to it. And it does take some time to try and make some sense out of all this stuff, so please bear with me. So one option is there is an ultimate reality, but it's always inconceivable. We can never actually pin it down through science or through philosophy. And because science is more concerned with how things work rather than the question of what is the ultimate nature of reality. And but the other option is that the ultimate reality is that there is no ultimate reality. And the only reality we have left is conventional reality. So we'll get to that more as we go through this. So just a little bit of background on metaphysics. So in the history of metaphysics, the nature of ultimate reality often revolves around how we make sense out of the relationship between change or difference and sameness or equality. Things stay the same, things change. What's a thing? So, for example, Plato, the most famous Western philosopher, argued that for something to be real, and in Western philosophy and also in Indian philosophy, reality is equated with the truth. So something to be true, it has to be real. So for Plato, he argued that for something to be real, it has to be unchanging and eternal. Plato argued that the world of change was illusory and not real. In this way, he was following in the footsteps of a pre-Socratic philosopher called Parmenides. Plato called the real and the true the world of forms. This belief in the existence of what are called universals, is called realism in philosophy. So for Plato, there is a real universal that exists eternally in the realm of forms that is imperfect, which is imperfectly reproduced in the world of change. So for example, in Plato's world, there is a real giraffe that exists eternally, and but the giraffe we see in the world is imperfect and changeable. The alternative to this is the viewpoint that argues ultimate reality is always changing. The pre-Socratic philosopher most identified with that is called Heraclitus, and he argued that reality is flux, and that you can never step in the same river twice, or you can never step in the same river once. From this viewpoint, universals don't exist. They are merely names. Designations of composite entities. So, like we talked about last month, the name chariot is simply a label we give to a collection of composite parts that function in a useful way. So, it's very useful to have the name chariot. Bring me your chariot. But actually, there is no ultimate reality called a chariot. And when you go in search of the chariot, you never find it, you know, you find all the different parts. And parts of parts and parts of parts of parts, and so on. This viewpoint in philosophy is known as nominalism. So, Buddhism it tends to be a lot of, well, Nagarjuna is certainly a nominalist. So, sometimes this debate in metaphysics is known as the one and the many. And you'll sometimes come across that in Zen as well. Is ultimate reality an undivided, eternal substance that only appears to change? Or is reality a flow, a process that is constantly changing from moment to moment, with permanence being an illusion? Rather than falling on either side of this duality, Zen Buddhism, as a philosophy and practice of non-duality, seeks to understand the one and the many as being two primary ways in which perhaps ultimate reality presents or manifests itself. We could say it is both one and many at the same time, or we could say it is neither one nor many. Any questions, comments? No questions, no comments? Jack, no? No.
Yeah, Sono, do you mind if we just, can you just scroll back again? That last page we were on? I just needed to hear that again.
What, the one and the many?
From Heraclitus, from there, could you go, could we?
So Heraclitus was the kind of the philosopher of flux. And, you know, the famous saying of his that you can't step in the same river twice. So from that process viewpoint, universals don't exist. They are merely names, designations of composite entities, like the chariot example. And that kind of philosophical position in the West is known as nominalism, as opposed to realism.
Yeah, and then can we just read the next one again as well?
And then sometimes this metaphysics debate was known as the one and the many, and you see it in the ancient Greek philosophers and you see it in the Eastern philosophy. Is ultimate reality one? Is it simply undivided, eternal substance that only appears to change? Or is reality basically just flowing, changing moment to moment, with permanence being the illusion? So is Buddha nature impermanence, or is Buddha nature eternal? Or is Buddha nature permanently impermanent? Or is it neither permanent nor impermanent? Anyway.
And therefore it does not exist.
Yeah, well,
perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing we'll get to with Nagarjuna is that for something to exist, it has to be real. And according to Nagarjuna, for something to be real, it has to be unchanging, permanent. Yeah. And so, Nagarjuna's impact on Buddhist thought was so significant that he is sometimes referred to as the second Buddha. We don't know much about the historical person. The Nagarjuna, the name Naga, comes from the Nagas, this mythical realm of lizard-like beings had custody of the Prajnaparamita Sutras. The argument was that the Buddha taught these, but they were secret teachings. They were kept in this domain of the Nagas, and the Nagas gave them to Nagarjuna, who then revealed them to the world.
That would fit in with some of the modern concepts of the lizard people. I'm sorry.
Maybe Nagarjuna was into that, what's that drug called? DMT?
Yes.
Yeah, right. He had a breakthrough to the other side and found the Prajnaparamita Sutras and brought them back to us. So anyway, he was probably an educated from a Brahmin family and south of India, was working in the second century of the Common Era. He was trained in the Vedic tradition. Nagarjuna established the practice of discussing Buddhism in Sanskrit, the shared language of the educated classes, rather than lots of the other vernaculars like Pali and so on. The text is composed in short verses known as karikas, which was standard genre for writing philosophy in those days. It helps with memory to write things in verse form. So he founded the school of philosophy known as Majjhimaka, or the Middle Way School. The central text is called the Mula Majjhimaka Karika, verses on the core of the Middle Way. And Nagarjuna references the growing body of the Perfection of Wisdom literature, the Prajnaparamita literature, among which the Heart Sutra is emblematic. And so just listen to this nice quote. It kind of like summarizes his philosophy. In the abstract, Nagarjuna's basic argument is fairly straightforward. For something to be real, that's sat or being or existing, for something to be real, it must be permanent and unchanging. It cannot arise, change in any way, or cease to be. Thus, for anything that is composed of parts, abhava, or is a basic component of our experience world, a dharma, to be real, it must be eternal. It never comes into being from causes and conditions, since whatever is eternal never arose or ceases, since that would be a change. It must also be unchanging during its existence, since a change would not be eternal. So too, it is not created by anything else or in any way dependent upon anything else, since it would then not have its own independent reality. Nor can it affect anything else, since that would involve a change. Thus, it must exist by its own very power. So too, its very nature cannot change in any way or be the result of any dependence upon something else. In sum, what is real exists totally independently of all other things and any causes or conditions. Thus, it must be self-contained in both its nature and existence. In short, it must exist by its own existence, svabhava. So you can see, in a way, that's almost like in the West, we probably define that as God or something like that. And again, you know, you might have some spiritual teachings that argue that there is only one reality and everything else is a kind of illusion. That's kind of like Advaita Vedanta. So this is what Nagarjuna, you know, he defines. This is what what he's going to do, and what he does in his book is he basically goes through all the different sort of factors of reality, whether it be that, you know, oh, there's heaps of them, like senses, the aggregates, the desire, agents and actions, suffering, lots of things he talks about in his book, the Four Noble Truths, and time and self and entities and so on and so on. And he basically argues that none of these things are real. None of them exist independently. So the four extremes, he argues that nothing exists in this way. So is number one, is not number two, three, both is and is not, and four, neither is nor is not. So basically, do things inherently exist? And he argues no. Do things not exist? And he argues no. If they don't exist in the first place, they can't not exist. Both is and is not. Do things sometimes exist and not exist? He argues no. And do things never sometimes exist and never not exist? And he argues no. So basically, he's arguing that nothing, in a sense, exists. And sometimes Nagarjuna is accused of nihilism in this regards. But let's just keep going for a minute. So what we need to understand is what he's arguing is, when we say something is empty, what is it empty of? It's empty of inherent existence. That's all we need to understand, really. All phenomena, Nagarjuna argues, including ourselves, are empty of inherent existence, what's called in Sanskrit svabhava. Everything in samsara and nirvana, the way everything exists, is empty of inherent existence. However, this doesn't mean nothingness. And because this is, there's two poles that he wants to avoid and what Buddhists wants to avoid. One is nihilism or nothingness, and the other pole is eternalism. So the middle way is neither eternal nor nothing. So how does he do this? And I'll just come to Pingala. Question, comment, Pingala.
I mean, he's coming from the perspective, I take it, of human existence, of our perception as our mind is now of these things. I mean, if we were, say, we were dead, it'd be different, wouldn't it? It's an embodied perception that he's coming from.
Well, he's actually undermining, using this notion that universals don't exist. So in a sense, he's arguing that there are no phenomena, including people, are inherently existent. Not even the teachings of Buddhism are inherently existent. And but rather than saying that, but that doesn't mean there's just nothing. There's obviously something, and as you'll find out as we go through this, we arrive at this notion of what's called the two truths, the conventional truth or conventional reality and the absolute nature of reality. We tend to come back to conventional reality as being, it exists, but it ultimately doesn't exist, but it only exists conventionally. So let's talk more about that. So another key word, dependent origination, in Buddhism, sometimes interdependence called, a definition of dependent origination is simply when this arises, that arises. When this does not occur, that does not occur. So this sort of notion of dependent origination is just noticing, you know, the regularities of our, of what happens in our lives. So, you know, reality has these sort of regularities, but regularity, even regularity, is nominal. It's just something which we construct through our language, our linguistic conventions. So we speak conventionally of one thing causing another thing, but all we actually experience is irregularities. And this was also David Hume, a Western philosopher's argument. All we ever experience is associations, one thing happening and then another thing happening. We don't actually experience causality. That's a concept. So causation also, Nagarjuna argues, is empty of inherent existence. So all Buddhists agree that interdependence is a fundamental feature of reality. And for some Buddhists, interdependence is a feature only of conventional reality. Nagarjuna is famous for what you might call his anti-foundationalism. That is, its emptiness or relationality all the way down. Everything, including dharmas, are empty of intrinsic existence. Whatever is dependently co-arisen, Nagarjuna tells us, that is explained to be emptiness. So Nagarjuna agrees with the Abhidharmas that wholes do not exist. However, he disagrees that dharmas are indivisible and independent, like the objection to the Brahman's position that the big self is independent and unchanging. Nagarjuna's objection to his Amidharma colleagues is that they also have inadvertently committed the same error by re-establishing the independence of distinctive selves in the simple elements of reality. The Buddhist teaching, he claims, is not just that there are no personal selves, But there is no self of any sort anywhere. All things, concepts, dharmas are empty of intrinsic nature, are empty of self in that definition. This, he suggests, is the unavoidable implication of the core Buddhist claim that all arises dependently. Whatever has constituents depends upon those constituents for its existence and depends upon our conceiving this many as a one for its unity, and so does not exist ultimately, but only at best conventionally. Whatever depends on its parts for its identity exists only conceptually, because it is our conceptualizing that makes a one out of many. Anything dependent upon another for its existence does not have any independent identity or nature of its own. So that's why interdependence is synonymous with emptiness. For something to be interdependent means it's lacking independent or inherent existence. Every material phenomenon is dependent in three important senses: dependent upon causes and conditions for its existence. So the plant is dependent upon the cause of the seed, and the seeds dependent on conditions such as rain and the quality of the soil and the sunlight. It's dependent on its parts and the holes on which it figures. So you can break everything down to smaller parts, or if you take the organs of the body, they're also dependent upon the other organs in the body. They're dependent on being in a larger whole, etc. And also everything is dependent on conceptual, very importantly, conceptual imputation for its identity, basically language. We project onto this, whatever it is, this flux, these concepts of identities and characters, which we superimpose onto that kind of whatever it is that we're calling reality. And so you can see now how when we get to the, and I'm going to finish today on the Heart Sutra, like when we get to the Heart Sutra, it's talking about prajna and the meditation of realizing emptiness. And when it's talking about seeing that all the five streams, which are the five aggregates, are without boundary, like boundlessness in this sense is being used as lacking any inherent existence. There's no boundary to anything. There's no demarcations anywhere. Everything else is everything's dependent upon everything else. And also boundlessness itself or emptiness itself is also empty, which we haven't got time to go into today, which we'll get to, but basically, the notion or the concept of emptiness is dependent upon conventional reality or language. So language which creates the concepts of emptiness. And so we get this identity of the absolute or boundlessness or emptiness with conventional reality. And so everything that we experience, everything, feelings, perceptions, inclinations, discernments, they're also like this. They're all empty of inherent existence. Hence, when it says, when we have those funny lines in the Heart Sutra about, there are no eyes, ears, nose, tongue, or body, or it's free of the eye, ears, nose. There's nothing that exists independently. The eyes, ears, nose, tongue, they're all conventions. It's all conventional existence, a way of talking about things. And they don't actually exist ultimately. Similarly with the notions of the teachings themselves, the whole notion of the Four Noble Truths and the path leading to the ending of suffering, they're all based upon conventional reality. They don't actually exist ultimately. So the Heart Sutra is just basically pointing to this lack of inherent existence in everything. So when you read the Heart Sutra next time, just try that on. So we get to this notion of the two truths, the conventional truth and the ultimate truth. And this dual thesis becomes the famous doctrine of the two truths or two realities. Two truths, ultimate truth is emptiness, and the conventional truth is everything else. Conventional truths do exist, but ultimately they are empty. But these two truths are not contradictory. They're kind of like complementary, like two sides of one coin or two sides of your hand. And so he reduces all the claims to independent existence to absurdity, and rather what counts as real ultimately depends precisely on our conventions. So for example, if you take a book, we can't find anything that is a book. We find pieces of paper stuck together, we find ink on the paper, and we find glue maybe sticking the book together, and it's also comes, and we also call it a book, so we know what it is, but it's actually, it's just a convention. We call it a book. We could call it a blah blah. So there's no such thing as a book. It's just a conventional, it's just a, simply a designation, the label, which serves as a practical form of communication. You know, in the same way, you could look at something like money. You know, that's obvious how money is conventional reality. And we have paper notes, we have metal coins, we have bitcoins, we have digital currency. It only works because we all agree to the convention. It's basically an agreement within our culture that this counts as money. Same with traffic lights, green and go. They're all conventions. And it's the same for people as well. The name Andrew just refers to this, whatever this is, but there's no inherent existence in Andrew. And so the argument is we can demonstrate this as Nagarjuna does through rational arguments. Our mind projects, obviously, inherent existence onto phenomena. And we just need to then become mindful of the way in which we project inherent existence onto phenomena. We need to recognize that. And we need to, because if we still live and relate within conventional reality, but when we begin to realize emptiness, hopefully that kindness tends to wake us up a little bit to how we can be hypnotized by conventional reality. We wake up to emptiness. We wake up to the reality of impermanence and interdependence. But at the same time, we need to honor conventional reality, and we need to abide by the rules of conventional reality. But when we have a deep realization of emptiness, we experience less attachment, with the argument would be, to the sense of self as being independent. And hopefully our reactivity diminishes as we realize that more and more. So we have to comply with and live within conventional reality, because that's the only reality we really have. Because what would happen if we stopped recognizing the existence of conventional reality? I'm going to stop now. So if we didn't recognize the existence of conventional reality, we would end up in the mental health unit, right? So we're going to have to stop. So I'm just going to open it up now for concluding questions or comments, and we'll talk more about this next time I talk. I'll send you a copy of this PDF as well.
What I'm getting is that our reality is, well, it all is really a construct of our minds.
Yeah, you could say, when we get to the Yogacara teachings, they will kind of argue that line, Pingala, but from the emptiness, from Nagarjuna's teachings, you might say it's a product of language or culture as well. You could argue that.
Thank you very much for the talk, Sono. I find it easier to understand the idea of nothing having inherent existence by adding the word independent. Nothing has inherent independent existence, and you use them interchangeably. It's the same concept. Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing is independent or autonomous.
Yeah.
Or existing from its own side. You know, sometimes the Tibetans will say it has no existence from its own side. A chair has no existence from its own chair. It only has existence from our side. We create the chair.
Yeah, that makes it, helps understand the concept of emptiness a little more, to understand it as nothing is independent. And so that koan of the monk who understands that everything is empty, and of the mind, and then goes out and stubs his toe on a rock and hurts himself and says, well, what's this?
Yeah, there's something there, isn't there?
Yeah.
But what it is, we can't really say.
We can feel it, though.
I'm wondering about the things that are out there, but that there's only a certain point in time that we know about them, like, say, for instance, X-rays or microwaves or something. So I'm just thinking, don't these things exist anyway, whether we have discovered them or not?
Are they the imperceptible forms?
Yeah, that's one of the debates that comes up as to does reality exist independently of our minds? And normally speaking, we'd probably say something about a qualified yes to that. We don't want to necessarily end up that it's all in just one mind, in my mind, that you're all just existing in my mind. That's like a solipsism. Science cannot really tell us what's the nature of ultimate reality. It can only really tell us how the regularities that come up, that they observe. And those regularities are arrived at by convention. They're arrived at by agreement between practicing scientists. So I think most of us would, we would say that there is a reality independent of my mind or your mind, Angie. But the question is, what can we know, really? That's the epistemological question. And I think Nagarjuna sort of ends up really that we come back to realizing this is all just a convention. That's the only thing we can really, that's the only truth we can really know. But there are other interpretations which will argue that, no, the nature of reality is ineffable, and we can have a kind of direct perception or intuition of that as well.